from the University of South Florida, and he has many years of experience in environmental and civil engineering. Jack McCarthy received his graduate degree from the University of South Florida, combining studies in geology, geophysics, and marine sciences. He initiated his professional career in 1975 as a research associate with the University of South Florida's Marine Science Institute in St. Petersburg, and began a career as an oceanographer and geophysicist, assessing geohazards and mapping the benthic environment for the U.S. Geological Survey. Gentlemen?
Thank you, Bill.
As with all presentations, you start off doing something with a computer and it fails, and you say, excuse me, so I'm going to try this. When it fails, I'll say, excuse me. Thank you very much. We were trying to figure out two things, answer two questions. One, why would you put the people that travel the farthest the first on a Saturday morning? Jack and I don't have an answer for that, but we think you are. The second was, Bill asked a question, which it didn't stop me, but I hadn't answered in a while. How did you get involved in this? And this isn't a full-time job. And I think, like a lot of people, it started with a backyard, becoming aware that there were activities in my neighborhood, being part of neighborhood associations, and then dealing with some of the impacts. For me, that started in 2005 when my neighbor came over and said, do you want to go to war? And immediately many things flashed through my mind, none of which involved the Withlacoochee Area Residents Incorporated, I can assure you. However, what we have here is I live in a little town called Yankee Town, which is, yes, it was named after the New York Yankees. No, it was named after the Yankees that fished there, and the postmaster didn't want to call it Old Town, which is what it was called. And when they brought mail, it was to bring it to the Yankees, and eventually it became Yankee Town. It's on the Withlacoochee River, the Gulf of Mexico. It's on southwestern Levy County, right across the river's northwestern Citrus County. The town of Inglis, Highway 19, right down here is the Crystal River Power Plant. And in this area are several mines. There's the Holcim, CMEX Holmes Corporation, and a little mine over here called Crystal River Quarries.
Yeah.
These are lime rock sand mines. Lime rock and some sand. This picture, each green dot represents a landowner. So this area, I think those of us who've lived in Florida long enough know, is called a land sales area. Lots were sold 50 by 50, the people who bought them. However, it is becoming much more a growth area. This area is a weekend travel park area. There's several hundred people who keep trailers there and come out from Orlando and Tampa. This area where the black line is called River Road, and a lot of the my neighbors that are impacted by this mine began to, in 1984, come together in the Withlacoochee Area Residents Group. Now, we have used a quote since 1986 when the group has been together, and we've personally met many times with this attorney, Mr. Stillwell, and it's one of those things that I would say to this group, when you're dealing with these things, you're going to be dealing with a long time. Be careful what you say, because sometimes it will come back to quote you, because they have quotes we've uttered that if this one can hang around for 22 years, or I can assure you some bars will hang around. In our area, Citrus County, basically the entire regulation has been called a separation of uses. It's a 3,000-foot separation. There's virtually no other regulations that impact. I'll get into that in a little while. As I said, our focus has been on the CEMEX mine. This has been in existence since the early 80s. It's gone through periods of activity, a few periods of very little activity. For those of you, and I am a civil engineer, but not even a civil engineer can like the barge canal, which this is. It's the straightest ditch in Florida for the longest period. This is the Withlacoochee River, the Gulf of Mexico, Highway 19. Jack's going to talk a lot about this became a hydrologic island. We made it that way. The river, and the dam. So it's a very different than some other areas that deal with regional hydrogeology and hydrology things. We put together a lot of material. This came from, one of the presentations about expansion. Eventually the area, this is the existing, the area would become a solid mine pit of 600 to 800 acres out of approximately 2,000 acre area. That's kind of huge. And this area right here is a state preserve. This area is a state preserve area. So you can see you've got the mine in an area that has the area is actually some of it encroached on the mine, because the mine was there before some of these folks moved in. So you've got a balancing act that's been trying to occur. But we went through this incompatibility with the county commission, because this is our big thing. This is the CEMEX mine that's looking towards the Gulf of Mexico, and large canals down here, and Withlacoochee's to the north. We've had all these issues raised. And I'm going to talk a little bit about noise, because there's two kinds of noise, and it's not the one you think about. Our big thing was it's incompatible, so you need regulations on incompatibility. As I said, just a general thing, we were formed in 84, we had about 300 members. Over time, members leave, interest wanes, we're down to about 100, or actually we're up to about 150. A lot of it is because we had some activity in Citrus County. We're currently putting together the county is, and all the groups are working on a new mining ordinance that's been cherry-picked from a lot of mining ordinances that I know people in this room have probably read and dealt with. They're trying to put that together. We're dealing with the state issue of you put an ordinance together to have it preempted, or you wait till it's preempted, so that whole issue. Just a couple facts in the last 3 years. It's a heavy, I almost said burden, that's not the right term, but it is. I mean, if you want to go to a meeting at 7 o'clock at night after you've worked, or you've gone down and seen the grandkids, and you come back to go to a war meeting, you're putting your own personal effort. So I'll say the word burden. We made 6 presentations to the planning committee, 4 to the board, meetings with staff of water management, DEP, Citrus County, briefings, fundraisers. And this one, we spent in the last 3 years $40,000 on legal fees. We've had some fundraisers. We've also had some people dig into their pockets. $40,000 sounds like a lot of money, is to me, but it's cheap. We've been outspent, I'm sure, at least 3 to 1, maybe 10 to 1. But you need at some point to have a lawyer to speak, lawyers speak with other lawyers. It's like watching two people from, I can't pick the metaphor, but there's a legal language, and when you don't speak it, you might as well be just have put your earmuffs on. So we had a really good one. He's since retired. We have another one that's excellent, and they give us great rates, and but they've got a mortgage to pay too. So we've had a lot of meetings, about 25 per year, the ward directors, and that's a lot of Sundays, a lot of Wednesday nights, and I have a file because, as somebody pointed out, I'm a Virgo, so when I loosen up, I'm able, retentive. So I've got 2,878 email messages in my my war file in 3 years. That's a lot. So you have to be in it for the long haul. It's not go to one meeting, raise your hand, and like that ad does, fix Social Security, thank you, it's all done. It's a long haul thing. We're going to go through a couple general lessons. Jack and I are called the water boys of the group because we deal with water. Jack has got some very good things on the regulatory inadequacies we've discovered. I've got some more general things that we've gone through that I wanted to give to this group. The title is kind of how to deal on these regulatory issues. First off, it goes without saying, so you better say it. If you've got a group, tap the talents. Don't let one person rule things, because we discovered we had all kinds of people with all kinds of talents, and that's helped a lot. We also, you know, if you were involved in something 10 years ago, if someone said you needed a web designer, we all would have been, yeah, we really do. What is it? And now, most people can reach out and find somebody to put together a web page, and you do need that. It's a great communication tool. This one we learned. First off, the newspaper is not your friend and it's not your enemy. It's business and you are part of it. And they want to use you and you should use them. And it's great, you know. It's also, something we learned is that when you're trying to have an impact on county and state, county, regional, and state agencies, one of the most amazing things is called the clipping service. Every senior executive at DEP, Swift Mud, and Citrus County gets a clipping service, and when their agency is mentioned, it is electronically clipped and sent to them. And they don't like the fact that we write letters to the governor and it turns up in a newspaper, you know, war, blah, 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 to the governor, blah, blah, blah. Amazingly, you get a lot more attention that way. And I'm not saying you should do it a lot, but use the newspaper. Go to the editorial board, ask for a meeting with them. They really do like to talk to people because that's how they make a living. Don't get into an argument. My first boss said, never argue with somebody that buys ink by the tanker truck. It's true. You can fire off an email, but they print. So try to avoid arguments with them. We probably put, conservatively, 20 times the effort that the agencies put in on our issue. Our issue started off as just the CMEX mine. Excuse me. But with those efforts, it was to get the agencies to interact, the personnel, get them to, many times we've growled, do your jobs. Now, it's not that these are incompetent people and we can degrade them, but our mission was to help them do their jobs, because we're just really small potatoes to them on a lot of issues. Big potatoes to us, small potatoes to them. But they began to react, and they will react to the squeaky wheel. They will react to you being in their face and just saying you've got to do something about this, if you give them something to react with. We quickly dropped off the, I'm mad, I don't like this, do something. Because you don't get anywhere with that with permit agencies. But that in a minute. You need multi-level agency strategies. What works at Citrus County Planning Board does not work at FDEP permit review people. Permit reviews are very different than zoning decisions. Zoning decisions, to me, are very emotional. They're very technical on points of law, but they're very emotional. And they're usually to start something. Permit and permit modifications are very technical. They're on nuances. They're on impact. And if you don't speak that language, you're given polite attention. And part of the problems I've gotten into in life are when people have given me polite attention, at some point I get mad. But that's another problem. Cultivate friends in review agencies. You know, you say, well, don't walk in and say you're all incompetent and, you know, now I want you to help me. Because it didn't work. But we did find that in every agency there are people that you can talk to that are your friends, that will give you information that you can work with, and we cultivate them. This one, since I am a consultant, I can say this, they're professional, but they're not as dedicated as we are, and they can't be, you know, because at the end of the day, if you're a professional, a lawyer, you're doing a job, you're trying to do a good job, you're trying to get something done for your client. But if you're in an NGO, a group that's trying to say, wait a minute, what about this and what about the impacts, you've got a different dedication, so take advantage of it. This one is, have one pit bull in your group. You know, we're not all nice people in our group. We've got several people that are not quite as nice as I am. And I'm not a nice guy. So rotate the pit bull. Have somebody that agitates. If you just become a nice, quiet group that they can get your letters or your emails and respond, and it's a nice little thing, you don't get anywhere sometimes. You need to unleash a Charles Myko ex-submarine commander whose idea is, when they're all dead, we've won. You say, no, Charles, that's not our thing. And Dixie would agree to that. And Charles has been involved in this for 25 years, so it's a lot. We also have some other people that are very smooth and regular, so you need to balance that out. This is something we discovered, and it's one of the background things we're dealing with presenting on the impact to an area. One of the first things you've got to understand is mining is an economic activity. It's obviously a huge environmental activity, but most of the time you don't know what the economic impact is. As a matter of fact, you assume it's huge, and people on the mining side, will not tell you it's anything less than huge. You know, they are holding up the economy of the city, the state, the region, Florida, intergalactic probably. And go to your tax rolls, pull out how much taxes were paid by mine, how much were paid by you, how much were paid within a certain area. Here I showed earlier, this is the taxes that were paid west of 19 that are impacted in this area. These are the taxes paid east of 19. These are the taxes paid by Florida Power, others, and 4% is paid by the mine. Now, that's powerful when you present to a county commission, because this does not take into account jobs and ripple effect and other things. That's not what we're trying to present. And we present, that's another thing, is we present honestly. Now, that's again, for a consultant to say the words, you got to grab your wallet. But it's like, honestly, what? We present, these are the taxes, property taxes, that are paid by people. And the vast majority are paid by people in industry in that area, are paid by the people. It's not paid by the mine. That had a powerful effect of, oh, you have standing. Let me go through a couple of real quickly regulatory issues. Blasting. Mines involve blasting. It's regulated by the state fire marshal. It's not regulated locally. We know that, and it's one of the things immediately when you talk about mining, people talk about blasting, noise, vibration. It's not a local issue. Yelling at the staff or the county commission or SWFMUD or DEP, it doesn't do any good. They immediately take it to it's a fire marshal issue. It's very, very specific. There's one U.S. Bureau of Mines standard that fits all. It actually doesn't, but that's what the regulations in Florida are based on, particle velocities, a whole bunch of other things. We have two people in our group that truly understand blasting and all of that. I'm not one of them, but I've listened to them interface, and it is a state issue. Depth of mine cut's very important on that, and I'll get to that later, but monitoring documentation, this is typical of what we've found when several of us got involved. A, it either doesn't exist, or it's on an as-needed basis, or excuse me, as-requested basis. And since nobody ever requested it, you know, there's no data. Okay. Whose fault is that? Well, it's not my fault, but there's no documentation on these issues when you go back and try to look at it. So you have to agitate to get it done. At the Citrus County level, noise is not blasting. First thing, we're not talking about blasting when we talk about noise. That's in the state. If you talk to the county about blasting, you get glass eyes and thank you very much type responses. We're talking about noise that's generated by hours of operation at 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. We're talking about noise generation equipment, noise attenuation that can happen. And we've said that buffers are not the total answer. When you have dragline mining, a buffering at 30 feet is not adequate for other things. And again, monitoring documentation. Very few counties, and especially Citrus, which is a rural county that's in the path of growth, they don't have noise monitoring staff. They don't have people out to do these things. Just for instance, the Citrus County started with a 90 dBA noise generation. And for those of you who know noise, a jet engine is, I think, 110, and a normal conversation is 40 to 45 to 60. You're supposed to sleep around 45. Their ordinance is 55 in an office. And this was taken from a study by the University of Washington on quarries for this type of equipment. You can see that the generation equipment is over 100, and Citrus was based on a 90. It was based on having a equipment like this, and it takes about 3,000 feet to attenuate, to die off from 90 dB down to the standard, which was one of those things that was one of the backgrounds of why we have a separation of use. Doesn't mean that you have to have a buffer that is owned by the mining company. In this case, a lot of it is owned by the state. There's a state preserve to the north that's about 2,000 feet. But that's where some of these come from. And it's not just the one drag line, it's also the equipment. It's the industrial area, the washing, the trucks. They've done a lot of work in trying to get away from the backup trucking, whatever that's called, that beep beep when you back up.
Beep 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 beep.
Which is a great sound other than at 2:30 in the morning on your back porch. That gets into the hours of operation issue, which is most mines in Florida have an hours of operation that are essentially dawn to dusk. This one, CMEX, does not, so they can and have mine or had activities, throughout the night. Noise studies have been done. This is the mining area. This was done to show that there really was an attenuation. There's four types of noise, and I just wandered into a world I don't understand. Everybody understands noise, but when you get to the science of it and presenting it, we have two people. One who's the noise expert for Progress Energy at Crystal River, and is responsible for those sirens that go off when the nuclear plant blows up, and they test them every Friday, and they go off. Well, his responsibility is the attenuation, the projection, the whole noise, so he really understands that stuff. Noise is many forms. This was done on a stationary, non-weighted, do-a-diddy thing. And I'm being silly about it because I really don't totally understand it, but you can project it out, you can add in the various sources, and you can come up with a noise profile. At the SWIFMUD and DEP level, the CMEX mine to them is small potatoes. This is about a 15-acre-a-year mine in northwest Citrus County. You compare that to all the other big phosphate mines, the big mines down in Miami, Broward, the mines in southwest Florida, and we're third on a list, third tier. Of course, at 2:30 in the morning, it's pretty one tier to me, so it's this kind of thing. And there's a lot of questions come up. This mine has been in existence since 84. It's had four or five different operators, and we've been digging into what is their responsibility. These two agencies are to manage and protect water resources and natural systems. That's part of their charge. They understand They're understaffed, but as I said, we have some friends there. They're dedicated environmental professionals in these areas. Do not make the mistake of ever denigrating them. At the political level, the board level, the executive director level, you've got some really sharp political people, and I'll leave it just at that. At the staff level, you've got some really dedicated environmental people, and you can. There's a lot of great synergy that can occur. They're reactive, but when the newspaper clipping services started dinging the board, dinging the bosses, flowed downhill to, who are these people? Why are they in the newspaper? Why are we getting letters from the governor's aide? What is going on? Why haven't you done this, Bill? And suddenly, they started reacting. If anybody in this room doesn't know it, DEP does water quality, Swift Mud does water quantity, and the two have never met. Even the word water is spelled differently, I believe, by them. And so you think, which one of you is responsible for this? And they both nod. And they seriously believe this. And they seriously have worked for 3 decades on parallel paths, occasionally coordinating. They are also, and that's a quote from a DEP person and a Swift Mud person, same words, they are in the business of permitting. That's what they do. You know, they are in the business of permitting. Monitoring documentation, again, as I said, we're third level. The monitoring documentation is not important to them. We have discovered things in their files that Jack will talk about that are great. We have a new program that we're doing with regard to these two agencies. It's about to come out. It's going to be great in terms of some of the regulatory inadequacies. And this is the mine again. And to us, it was all about water, not water quality, not water quantity, but the impact on water in this area. And with that, what we found was if you do work with the agencies, this is DEP, last year about this time, we had worked with them for about 6 months. This area I highlighted in yellow and underlined, but it was a preliminary application that had been turned in to expand the mine, and they sent out that they would be a preliminary denial letter. Now, that might cause for a lot of celebration, but as we've learned, it's a battle and a long war. It means that now we've gone through a consent order, a plan of study, there'll be some new work. But at this point, it was an indication. The permit was withdrawn, CMEX permit after that. And you put these little things on the wall and say, hey, that was a success, stopping it at that point. We studied a whole bunch of other counties recently. Citrus County, we believe, is the only one that has this separation of land uses. Without the 3,000-foot barrier, we have no regulations in Citrus County. Our mining regulations in Citrus County are a page and a half. They're actually half a page. One page is definitions. So it's basically unregulated other than for separation of use. It was regulated to the state level or referred to the state level. We're now in the process of preparing a mining ordinance in Citrus County. The county commission has gone through one draft. There's the Miners Association, there's WAR and several other groups and the county, and we'll see where that goes. And we do have people that understand graphics, and we put this together for a presentation to the county commission to explain all the things that a mining ordinance has to have that Citrus County does not. And you've got to do all these things. You've got to have performance base. Mining has to pay the cost. Monitoring, regulation, enforcement. Right now, that's a county cost. We're trying to prohibit mining in the floodplain, wetlands restoration for new mines, buffering, monitoring, and Citrus does not. And that became one of our presentations to the county commission. It was Citrus does not. And
I figured this was going to go in the
box. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Jack, who's going to be a lot more technical than I am. And then we're here, I understand, for any questions afterwards.
Yeah, my name is Jack McCarthy, and hopefully we'll get, where are we? As Ron said, to us anyway, mining was really all about water. We originally got involved in the war because of some blasting impacts, and I live, my wife and I live just north of the mine, and we noticed in 2005 there were a lot of minor plumbing failures, usually seals of toilets in our house. Our house was built by a plumbing contractor, so there's toilets all over the place. And then some plumbing separation at stress risers, where the plumbing comes from the well to the house and the well into the house, you know, where, and so that got my interest because it was taking up a little time repairing things as we went along. And it was kind of unusual because normally the blasting had not been very consequential. And so I went over one day, and my wife and I went over, and we took a little tour of the mine. And I just wanted to look at the rocks to see what the energy transmission characteristics were. And I started looking at, realizing the scope of this mine, and I said, well, this is, you know, a water issue. Because knowing, as Ron pointed out, we're on a hydrologic island, and there's very little upland recharge, except maybe in the deeper units that go beneath the river. But basically, the area is bound on the north side by the Withlacoochee, which is pretty much sea level all the way up to at least US 19, and the Barge Canal is sea level almost all the way up to the first lock. So there was no recharge that occurs there. And the proposal at the time in 2005 was also coincident. They wanted to, instead of continuing to mine in this area, which are already permitted for, they wanted to move up here. Let's see. So in perspective, if you start mining in this area, these people were going to be impacted greatly, and again, everybody on this is dependent on private wells. So we started looking for data to see what the impacts of this mine has been over the years, and that's where the problems began. Right. Yeah. Question here. All right. All these new techniques. This is the type of thing you run into, at least at the county commission level. I don't know if these types of statements are made to professional agencies, but this is a Florida licensed professional geologist with 35 years of experience, civil engineer also, and he says mines in Citrus County do not affect water levels because the mines in Citrus County do not do water or alter water table. He says, there are no water quality impacts from mining operations since there are no significant sources of contaminants in Lime Rock mines. So, anyway, basically I wanted to test that theory. You know, pardon my hydrotombs, but I found that real quickly when you go to the county commission and you show them a piezometric map, they sort of, their eyes glaze over and don't focus. So, used an oceanographic technique where we just, basically this shows the pre-mining condition of the area. This is the proposed, this is based on Faulkner's study he did. He did an impact study on the effect of the Barge Canal on this island, and or the island they created. And this basically was his interpretation of what the, at low water conditions, what the piezometric surface was like at that time. Basically, the recharge area here is what in Lake Rousseau, where some of the first changes were made to the hydrologic regime in the area, which dammed the river up about here, which is off this sheet. But and it basically drained into the river, and under low water conditions, you would have, this is the mining area ghosted in, you'd have about 5 feet of water where they're currently mining. Under high water conditions, there was almost 10 feet of water, or actually about 8 feet, 9 feet. after they got through the canal, and this is his basic control for developing this, this is what he found was left of it under low water conditions. And this was measured just after they were coming off one of those. Every decade we seem to have a 1 or 1.5 year low rainfall period. And anyway, this didn't even go to the primary contours. Basically, along the crest of the divide, it was less than 5 feet, and you basically couldn't close this by a 2.5 foot contour. So that's the water table. And in this case, it really is a water table because it's an unconfined aquifer, so at least on the surface. And all our recharge on the island, people who live on the island, and this is where the residents, they live along here, all in the river, and then a fair amount of concentration here, just north of the mine. So if it doesn't rain, this thing gets pretty low. And what we basically worked with, under their first water permit, I'm not sure when, I think it was issued around 85, 86, at least that's when they were applying for it, when they started mining on a large scale. Now actually, Ron noted that that's when they started mining, but as Dixie will point out, they were kind of picking away and had some glory holes long before that. But it was very small scale. In fact, I think by the time international aggregates came in, I mean independent aggregates, in 85, there was a kind of a trench here and a trench there and maybe a little expansion. But these, when they applied for a consumptive use permit, at that time they were still using, they were using processed water pumped from wells because the mine was fairly small. And so they had a consumptive use permit that they applied for, and they also set up a monitoring program, Swift Mud did. And I don't know if there was a staff gauge originally, there was in later years, but basically they had a north monitoring well, which was a long way from the pit at that time. Basically the pit was down in this area and up through here. They had one to the southwest. The one on the north was kind of near the potentiometric high I just showed you before, which the groundwater divide probably ran just right along the edge of the map and down here. Now Faulkner had a well right next to this. We just approximated here because it wasn't located as accurately as they do nowadays. But it actually plots out 300 feet east of this. I have a feeling it was on the other side of the property line, so we just threw it in there. That's Faulkner's main well, and I'll show you kind of a comparison of data from what it was like before there was mining and what it's like since mining. So basically, what I needed to do was find some data. And fortunately, WAR had acquired the monitoring data. And this is well 50, the north monitoring well, the one that's now on the north margin of mine. And so I kind of worked up a hydrograph for the first 2 years. And I tried to infill and see the impacts. And so we tried to get the data from the water district and Swift Mud. This is what they had. And if it looks a little strange to you, it's because it is. In fact, none of the data coincided with the data we had, which was based, or at least in the first 2 years, which was based on the sheets submitted to Swift Mud. Now, in most cases, on both the permits, it specifies they're supposed to submit the data at each well, water levels, which they only take once a month nowadays. When they first started, it was every 2 weeks, but they only they're supposed to submit it at relative to whatever the vertical national or North American vertical datum is. And there were some other little blanks they had to fill in on those sheets. And somebody, apparently a Swift Mud, the other little data blanks were the well ground elevation of the well and the standpipe height. Well, somebody at Swift Mud, apparently during this period, you see these two different modes. This is from about 84, 85. And this is from more recent years. I guess there was a big data gap here, but about 97 on or 96 on. Anyway, somebody started recording and entering all the data as depth below ground level. That's another way to measure water levels, it was, but that wasn't the way the permit specified. It wasn't the way it was submitted. So I noticed all the data were different than what I had recorded. As it turns out, if I had used the swift mud data for a comparison, I'll show you right after this, the impacts would have been even greater because the average water level would have been higher. But it, I think I have the correct interpretation. And this is a two-year hydrograph. This is the first couple of years where there was large-scale mining. This is 86 and 87. Actually, they did a little bit in 85, but the data were confused because everybody was confused about the type of sheets and what they were supposed to be submitting. And this is compared to 2005-2006. Note this is sea level. Now, this is near what was a potentiometric high, and it's down below sea level, right when it should be. Well, this is usually the rainy season. I don't have to cross-plot it with rain data, but I've done that, or we're starting to do that now. This little green line here, that's Faulkner's curve. And notice he had some continuous monitoring, and you see the events, a 2-inch rainfall event, you'd get maybe a 6-inch rise in aquifer level or potentiometric surface within a day or two. And then it would decay for a while, and you get some more rain. I've got a crossplot at the end, which I didn't figure I had time to show, but you see it's kind of unusual. And so one could argue that, I think very effectively, that the monitoring or the data acquisition interval doesn't capture a lot of these. You could miss quite a few. Plus, if you look at some of the dates that they acquired the data, it was supposed to be at a roughly a 30-day interval, plus or minus 7 days.
Jack, yes. Can you define zero and potentiometric for some folks in the crowd?
All right, yeah, it's just a water table elevation above sea level. It's very, very similar to, you can use the analogy of a topographic map for those of you that might be familiar with that. But and the importance of that is that's what basically, the height of the water level is what keeps, a seawater, freshwater type aquifer, it basically keeps the seawater from rising up in the aquifer. So you have what they call a Guyven-Hertzberg principle, but for every foot of freshwater head above sea level you have, in theory, theoretically, you'd have about 40, 41 feet of fresh water below it before you hit the saltwater interface. This is freshwater, saltwater. As it turns out, in this case, it's more complicated, but as it always is in karst. So what the bottom line is, we've basically there's been about a 70, but by my configuring, it's a 72% drawdown for these. And this is based on the mean during these two periods. Now, I should note, this was a low rainfall period. This was, it also turns out it was a high extraction rate period, too. They mined 26 acres that year in 2006, according to what they've reported. So, if I use the SwiftMud data, it would be about a 77% drawdown would be the difference between the 86, 87, and the 2005-2006. You just received the 2007 data, and we haven't looked at that real closely yet, but it's not quite as bad as 2006. It rained a few inches more, and the extraction rate dropped significantly. And then we get into water quality impacts. Well, here's what I've done is I've just made a table of the concentration of the three principal measurements they make, which is chloride, sulfate, and total dissolved solids. And in 86, you'll see here, and what's marked in red are basically when they exceed potable water standards. Well, the north monitoring well, the pit itself, and the southwest monitoring well almost, total dissolved solids were a bit high there, all basically potable water or barely potable water in the case of the southwest monitoring well. You look 20 years later, and the north monitoring well on average is still, and you start looking at the standard deviations, they're getting really high here. Something's happening here. There's a lot of contamination. You see the standard deviation is twice as high as the value in the case of sulfates. It gives you a hint something's going on. The pit water, has sulfates almost twice the level potable water standards, and corresponding TDS almost twice the level potable water standard. Those are milligrams per liter, so that's roughly 500, 1,000 for sulfate TDS. So basically we have about 6 or 7 billion gallons of non-potable water that's stored in that pit. The Southwest monitoring well, you see the chloride, obviously there's saltwater intrusion has occurred here. Now, actually this was pretty high chloride to begin with, but now it's probably around, that roughly is equivalent to about 10% of seawater, somewhere in that range. Of course, sulfates are lower because in seawater, you basically have a 10-to-1 ratio, roughly, between chloride and sulfate. In fact, that's why I have the sulfate-chloride ratios here, because that sort of identifies the dominant source water. When you get about 1% of a contaminated water, we basically have three water types here. We have the fresh water, which is calcium carbonate water, and you have seawater, which is basically sodium chloride water, and then we have what we call deep water, which is calcium sulfate water. And the deep water is found in a particular formation there, mining, the Avon Park, and lower, because what's happening is it's water that's been there a long time, and it's not moving very fast, not recharged very fast, and it's basically dissolving the gypsum that's in the formation. So there's been significant change in water quality there.
Jack, you got about 5 minutes.
Okay. One of the things with data, I showed you some elevation data with some of the problems. Well, here's a typical problem we run into in water quality control. The consultant that works these up prepares an annual report, and he says, if he sees an anomalous data point, he says, that's probably a lab error. Well, what I've done is taken two of the lab errors and I actually plotted. We left these plots off, but the dashed lines there are the plots. And this is from the North monitoring well, which supposedly was on the potentiometric high. This is 2006 data. And this is the Southwest, which are the only two long-term monitoring wells we have. And this is water level, and you'll pardon my, I grabbed my granddaughter's crayons and colored this in because that also shows some different things. But it turns out both of these, in both cases, and this is equivalent to that one here, these are all lined up at the same time, the same sampling period. They coincided when the quarry water was high because of rainfall and had a quick recharge event. We've seen hints of this in the past, but we've never, because of the low frequency of sampling, we've never really caught one probably right at the peak, and this one was very obvious. And what we found is, in this case, the pit water, which is high sulfate water, was just flowing right into the North monitoring well. And basically, I doubt if it stops right there, it actually flows north off the site temporarily. Eventually, the aquifer the recharge will occur. It doesn't occur as fast as it does in the pit, but and it'll flush it back out again, and it'll drop back down. And in this case, it was pit water that was flowing into the Southwest monitoring well, which normally has much higher chloride, which pit water doesn't. Pit water is about 1% chloride water right now. I think occasionally it gets a little higher, but it's hard to change the chemistry of pit water now because of the volume of pit water. Anyway, what I wanted to show here too is that basically don't discard the values immediately. Just because the consultant suggests you do that. And they actually say values in bold are probably lab errors. It's about the closest thing to an imperative you would read. And in the earlier years, I noticed they weren't saying it quite that way. So there's apparently a conscious effort to change the way you look at these things. And this is what the regulatory agencies, they look at that and they say, oh yeah, it's probably bad data. In the 2007, actually, 25% of the samples from the North monitoring well they wanted to discard because they're probable lab errors. In that case, it was chlorides are coming in. But that's another issue.
Anyway,
what I'm showing here, though, is that the normal gradient that used to exist in that area, the North monitoring well would be the highest, you would basically drop a foot and a half or so to the southwest monitoring well. That was the difference in elevation of groundwater between those. Well, now it just sort of rotates. The only one instance was the north monitor well significantly higher during the measurement period. Then it went to the pit was dominant. And then the southwest monitoring well was dominant, which means that that's when the influx and the saltwater encroachment comes in. And then back to the pit dominant, and then probably almost no gradient here. These again are elevations, so it's the system's all out of whack.
Go ahead and wrap it up.
Yeah.
Time for one question.
All right. Basically, this is, as a result of our efforts, Ron showed you that they asked the applicant withdraw his proposed expansion for this area and until they conduct a study to show that they wouldn't significantly impact water. And this is what they found out on the first. We've only seen it one spot, but this is the elevation. They added all these extra wells around here, and they added all those elevations. And this is the total change over the year. This is 1971, again, going back to what I showed you previously. Early at the time of that previous one, this is the previous chart. This is where the salt water is now. And this is what I thought was left. Now I'd probably draw this, and the salt water, draw this much smaller. It's been truncated here. And what has caused the salt water intrusion in some of the wells occasionally on low water conditions along the river, which is the boundary of that. And that's about all I can cover right now.
Is Rob Brinkman here?
Right here.
Rob, do you need to load some material in the projector?
Well, actually, if I could just hook my computer up, that might be best.
Well, okay, and what I'd like to do, why don't you go ahead and do that?
What I'd like to do is leave the question.
Rob, I'm afraid you better hold up just a second.
Yeah, I think maybe it'd be better if you load it.
While they work through those issues, I'd like to save most of the questions and answers for the 11:30 session, but if anybody's dying to ask a question of these two gentlemen, any hands out there? Yes, sir, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, what do you attribute the impacts to mostly? Is it evaporation off the pit? Is that what's causing these?
Yeah, that's something.
The question was, is it the impacts mainly the evaporation off the pit?
Well, initially I thought that was probably the cause of the differences we were seeing with what we expected to see and what, say, the professional geologist was saying occurred. But the impacts were so great, and once we finally got some information relative to the extraction rate, it turned out the matrix extraction is probably dominant in an active quarry. Now, at some point, once the quarry reaches a certain size, we figured on this particular quarry, in 2006, they're approaching an average daily matrix extraction around 1.6 to 1.8 million gallons a day equivalent. And that was only implying a 10% correction for drain porosity and rock had taken out. But that's a lot of water, and it may be high, but it's still in the ballpark. Pan evaporation, depending on the season, maybe if you had a dry period in the summer, you might get something like 1.4 million gallon a day equivalent average. At the peak, if it didn't rain or something like that, to replace it. So that's the draft on the aquifer, and it's coming in. Well,
okay.
All right. Yeah, basically, there's two flow systems going on here. We've got intermediate or semi-confining layers at about 30 feet relative to sea level. And that's where the salt water and a lot of the exchange from the pit is occurring in that, the lateral flow, in other words. And then because of blasting, we have the deep water is coming up through the conduits created by the blasting based on, lowering the water level in the pit.
Thank you very much. Rob Brinkman has been the chair of the Suwannee St. John Sierra Club based in North Central Florida. And he's been involved in helping stop the Florida rock industries from obtaining a comprehensive plan amendment for a new mine in Putnam County. And he's going to talk to us about